student at Nagoya University, Japan. First of all, in the morning, I noticed a very, very important thing. Today is the March 14th. That is the 3.14. That's the Pi Day. Uh-huh. So that's great honor for me to give a seminar on such a wonderful day.
I know. And you're competing with the Pi contest. At Pi.
Yeah.
And the title of my talk is a CDT Hamiltonian from the Hojava-Refsis gravity. And this talk is based on the work with Yanambion, Lisa Gleiser, and Yoshiyuki Watabuki. Okay, first, there is a very interesting issue that the so-called Hojava-Refsis gravity really looks like the causal dynamical triangulations. First of all, though, it is Hojava-Refsis gravity is, roughly speaking, a quantum gravity with the anisotropic scaling. And this anisotropy between space and time specifies the one preferred time foliation. And on the other hand, this CDT is an abbreviation for the causal dynamical triangulations. And this is a lattice regularization for the Einstein gravity with the foliation structure built in. So what is the foliation? So if you think about the space-time as the space parameterized by the time, then if you pick up the one time, then you can write down the space parameterized by this time. And usually, this kind of spatial hypersurface is called foliation. And in Japanese, we call it the yoso, and its character stands for the layer of the leaf. So it has the same meaning, actually. So both theory has the foliation structure in common. And besides, there are several more evidences that CDT really looks like Hojava-Refsis. The first one is the behavior of the spectral dimensions. For example, the spectral dimension of the CDT is 2 at the ultraviolet and it flows to 4 at the infrared. And Hojava-Refsis gravity has the same structure of this spectral dimension behavior, right? And the another one is the phase structure of the diagram. CDT phase diagram has very interesting features, and this looks like a Refsis type. And this was firstly pointed out by Yanambion and his collaborators. Okay, so now we're attempting to say that the CDT really has some anisotropic point where the Hojava-Refsis gravity pops up in the low energy limit. But it's very hard to say or hard to prove this equivalence because it is very hard to do the analytical work in the 4 dimension. But at least in 2 dimensions, we can work in both theories analytically. So in our work, we exactly proved that this 2-dimensional CDT is exactly equivalent to the 2-dimensional Hojava-Refsis gravity by quantizing the Hojava-Refsis. So in my talk, I shall explain about the punchline of this statement. So if you have any questions, please stop and ask me anytime you want. Okay, so this is the outline. First, I will explain about what is the 2-dimensional causal dynamical triangulations. And in this section, I shall derive the so-called CDT Hamiltonian. And in the next section, I will explain about the 2-dimensional Hojava-Refsis gravity. And by quantizing the Hojava-Lipschitz, one can get the quantum Hamiltonian, which is exactly equivalent to the one derived by the Hojava-Lipschitz causal dynamic triangulations. Okay, then I will conclude my talk. Okay. So what is the CDT? And CDT is a lattice regularization of the path integral for Einstein gravity. And in the CDT, we think about the geometries discretized by this kind of triangles. And this triangle has the fixed lattice spacing and internally flat. And an important feature is that the length of the triangle is separated into the time-like ring and the space-like ring. And each triangle has the direction of time. And this triangle is exactly the Lorentzian because lattice spacing for space and time has the Lorentzian signatures. Okay, and the gluing rule is as follows. Just you glue the time-like ring to the time-like ring and the space-like ring to the space-like ring. And to make the a neighborhood triangle has the same direction of time. And by this gluing rule, you can find this, for example, in the typical geometry, you find the foliation structures, like in these pictures. And besides, the baby universe creations are prohibited because of this gluing rule. These are the features of the CDT. And in the CDT path integral, we fix the boundaries and we sum up all the different shapes of the triangulated geometries. And to change the shape of the geometry, we change the way of the gluings of the triangles. And often it is called the triangulations. So in the CDT, we sum up all the triangulations with the fixed boundaries. And that's the path integral of the CDT. The parameter here, alpha, is taken as positive. Okay, to do the path integral, we have to define the action. And we start with the Lorentzian action. This is just a boring. In a two-dimensional case, it's very special because the curvature integral becomes just a constant. This is because of the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. So this integer is called the Euler number. This just specifies the topology of the Riemann sphere. In the CDT, the topology change is prohibited. So we just fix the Euler number. So we don't think about this. So we don't need to care about this curvature integral. So we start with the volume action, and we discretize.
You have boundaries, so it won't be strictly speaking.
Yes, it's minus 2b.
What? Minus 2?
Minus 2b, b is the number of the boundaries in that case.
Number of boundaries. But still, there should be some extrinsic curvature term if you want it to be the Gauss-Bonnet. If you want to get the Euler character, right?
Yes, in that case, yes.
It's not
yes,
just
yes.
enough to integrate with Ricci scaling.
Yes, exactly. But in any case, we don't need to care about that. Thank you. And so we discretize this action, and the volume is equivalent to the number of the triangles times the area of this Lorentzian triangle. And this alpha is the anisotropic parameter. And this lambda here is the dimensionless bulk cosmological constant. Right. Thanks to the foliation structure, we can always rotate this Euclidean action to a Lorentzian action by just changing the alpha to the minus alpha. So just for a computational reason, we just change the alpha to the minus alpha, and we get the Euclidean version of this action. And the two-dimensional case is actually special because this parameter can be absorbed by the redefinition of the this boundary bulk cosmological constant. So we just do that, and we finally arrive at this form of the Euclidean action. This is very simple. So we just use this action to compute the path integral. And in CDT, we typically think about the cylinder-like configurations. Then we fix the length of the link of the boundaries. And these boundaries are separated into the discrete time step t here. And this can be done by the summing up the all the different shapes of the geometries with the fixed boundaries. And this is the weight. And just for simplicity, we redefined e to the minus lambda as g. So please remember that if you have a triangle, you get the factor g here. From now, I would like to compute this amplitude. And to do that, it is very convenient to introduce the generating function of the boundaries. So we assign the y and x to the final boundaries and the initial boundaries. Right, and plugging this expression into the generating function, you finally arrives at this form. And this w is just a constant. This is the number of the triangulations with the fixed boundaries and the number of the triangles. All right, then this amplitude is called the propagator. And this has a very interesting properties, which is the composition rule. So if you pick up the two propagators, and actually you can glue it by summing up the intermediate loops. And we can write down this equation as the composition rule. So here we sum up all the different intermediate number of the links. Okay, and then also you can write down this composition rule for the a generating function. This can be done by the complex integral. So to compute this guy, we need only two informations. The first one is this one-step propagator, and the another one is this composition rule. So in this sense, I will compute this one-step propagator. So please remember that if you have a boundary length, the finite boundary length, you get a factor y. And if you have a one triangle, you get a factor g. So you find the up downward triangle, you get a factor gy. And also, if you have an upward triangle, you get a factor gx. So to compute this generator for the one-step function, all we should do is summing up all the different kinds of the way of gluing of these triangles. This is very simple, and you can done it. And this is the explicit form of the a one-step propagator. All right. And the another important thing, important guy, is this composition rule, as I mentioned. So just plugging this explicit form into the composition rule, you can get this interesting one-step recursion relation. All right, this is a bookkeeping device. I shall skip the detailed expression, but you find that this function becomes non-analytic at some specific values of the coupling constant. This is called a critical point, critical values of the coupling constant.
Would you mind showing how you derive this integral version of the composition rule? From the direct definition? You turn this composition rule into this complex integral.
Yes. I'm just picking up the pole of this function.
Yeah.
Then you can get the.
That's okay. I was just wondering if you could show explicitly, but it doesn't matter.
Okay, so then later I will explain.
Yeah.
Personally, okay. So the important point is that at this critical point, we can take a continuum limit of this discrete version of the generating function. As I mentioned in the beginning, the triangle structure of this causal dynamical triangulation is just a regularization. So if we want to get the physical quantities, you have to remove it in the end, right? So to do that, we should take a continuum limit. So roughly, I should explain about how to take a continuum limit. So to take a continuum limit, we have to do the two things simultaneously. First one is fine-tuning the coupling constant to a critical point, critical values. Then at this point, the number of the triangles diverge. And simultaneously, we shrink the lattice spacing to zero. So please imagine that the geometry is discretized, and the number of the triangles grows up to infinity. And simultaneously, you shrink the lattice spacing to zero. And under the fixed volume, then you can imagine that the surface becomes smooth. In this sense, we call it the continuum limit. And in this continuum limit, you can define the physical quantities. In this case, that those are the macroscopic loops and the macroscopic proper time. Here, for example, this L1 is the number of the initial boundaries. At the critical point, this L1 becomes diverged, and simultaneously, this epsilon shrinks to zero. Then you can get the finite length of the boundary. And in this process, you can transmit the dimension of the lattice spacing into a physical one. Yes?
Just a short question. This critical point that you're using, is that the only one that you have in your coupling space, or are there other critical points at which you can take the continuum?
This is the unique one. Thank you. And then, right? To do this continuum limit, to take a continuum limit, according to the renormalization group, we just need to renormalize the coupling constants and this G. So let's go back to the argument. Please remember that by using the one-step propagator and the composition loop, we arrived at this recursion relation. And plugging the renormalized constants into this recursion relation, you get some sort of differential equation for this renormalized generating function. And it's here, H hat is the Hamiltonian. And I want to get the differential equation for this propagator. So we have to do that. We should implement the Laplace transformation of this guy. And finally, you reach out this expression. So this is a very important quantity in my talk. This H hat is called the CDT Hamiltonian with a mark point. And sorry, I didn't mention about this mark, but this is kind of a reference. This is some analog of the coordinate in the quantum case. So please remember that this is the CDT Hamiltonian. And from now, I just quantize the two-dimensional Hojave lattice gravity, and we get the same Hamiltonian. Right. Yes?
So what's L2?
I'm sorry?
What's the variable L2?
Yeah, can you go back for that variable? Yes.
Here. Its variable is L.
But what is it physically?
The length of the boundaries.
Okay.
But where does the mark point enter into that formula? Or is it
the marking point appears in the composition rule.
So the mark points have to match up in the composition
rule. Yes. I think in the end of my talk, I should explain.
Okay. But
all right.
I don't understand. Is it just like introducing another factor depending proportional to the length of the boundary or something like this? Because I don't see it. It's not in the dynamics anywhere except in this matching rule. You don't have any term in the action or anything involving the mark point is only on the boundary, is that right?
Yeah, right.
Does each slice have a mark point? It sounds like it might just be a factor proportional to the length of the boundary.
Yeah, in the end, it's something like that. Then get something said to join. Here, the measure is slightly non-trivial. If it's LV, L or something,
and
L might be for this, your length vector.
Sorry?
L might be this length vector.
The length.
Mm.
Okay.
Sorry. Okay. Then? I will explain about the Hojave lattice gravity next. Before moving on to two dimensions, I will explain about what is the Hojave lattice gravity in four dimensions. Please remember the ADM decomposition of the Einstein gravity. And here H is the induced metric on the foliation, as N is the Laplace function, as Kij is the extreme curvature, and K is the stress. And R is the spatial width scalar, and this is a cosmological constant. And of course, this action is invariant under the Fourier diffeomorphism. An important thing is that this coupling constant has the negative mass dimensions. In this sense, the Einstein gravity is non-renormalizable at the level of the power counting. But on the other hand, Hojave lattice gravity is defined by this anisotropic scaling. And this exponent z characterizes the anisotropy between space and time, often called the dynamical critical exponent. And because of this anisotropy, the full space-time symmetry is broken down to a foliation preserving one. And especially for this time, this symmetry, it just becomes the reparametrization for time. All right. And you can write down the action which is invariant under the foliation preserving diffeomorphism. This is the Hojava-Lefschetz action. And a striking difference is here, the coupling constant lambda, and also the potential term. And this is called the potential because this part does not include any time derivative terms. And then, and this potential can be described by the highest spatial curvature invariance. And this series can be determined by if we fix the critical exponent z. And thanks to this anisotropy, the important point is that this coupling constant could have a positive mass dimension. If we choose the this z large enough. Okay, and then from now, I will explain about the two-dimensional Hojava-Lefschetz. It is very special because in the two dimensions, this Kij is equivalent to the k squared, and also the potential term, all terms are vanishes except for this cosmological constant term because the one-dimensional Rich scalar is zero. Okay.
One question on the when you go back to the CDT, the two-dimensional CDT, when you took the continuum limit, you had this anisotropy parameter. How does that behave?
I just absorbed anisotropic parameter by the redefinition of the lambda here.
Okay.
So it's very confusing, but this lambda is the cosmological constant, and absorb this anisotropic parameter by the redefinition of the cosmological constant.
So is it meaningful to ask how in the since you can't just separate out the anisotropy parameter from the cosmological constant? I mean, I was going to ask how it scales. Is it going to zero? Is it going to infinity? But are you saying it doesn't really have an answer because you absorb, can't distinguish it from lambda?
But I think this alpha does not play any role in two dimensions because we can't absorb.
How would you see anisotropic scaling then?
In a CDT.
Yeah.
Well, in a CDT, there is a foliation structure built in. And then at this level, we can see the anisotropy between space and time because we just specifies the law of the time and space.
We have alpha. But he says the alpha is absorbed into lambda. So you can't, if you're not, there seems to be no distinction between how you scale alpha or how you scale lambda or something. I mean, I don't.
Alpha is an isotope.
It is the anisotropy. But it seems to have dropped out of this.
Yeah,
in two dimensions, it seems to have dropped out something.
So can you drop it off in Rova-Lichy too?
No, I think it's
Let him answer.
Can
you drop the anisotropic parameter in the raw valid sheets too? Since you can draw
the energy.
Can you reabsorb the anisotropy into the cosmological constant? Here you're saying in CDT you can reabsorb the anisotropy in the cosmological constant, so the same should be possible in raw valid sheets. Or not? In 2D or raw valid sheets?
Yes, in 2D it's possible. So when we take the quantum limit, we can reabsorb this parameter alpha in at least in two dimensions.
So it's a feature of 2D, I guess. So in 2D, there is no real anisotropy in some sense.
Yeah, that's funny.
If you can reabsorb it into the cosmological constant, it means it's not there.
Yes, in 2D, yes.
So there's no difference in 2D between raw valid sheets and usual gravity in 2D.
In 2D. Yes. And I shall explain later, but also in Hochberg lifshitz, we can absorb the anisotropic parameter by the redefinition of the cosmological constant.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the situation is the same. This is our starting action. This is two-dimensional Hochberg lifshitz gravity. And as I explained, there is no curvature term. And here, gamma is defined by the square root of the spatial metric. And its k is the extrinsic curvature. And this and 1 is the shape function. And additionally, we think about this is the projectable version. Projectable version means that the lattice function is only the is a constant on the foliation. So this just becomes the function of only time. So we pick up this action, and then I'd like to quantize this two-dimensional Hochberg lifshitz gravity. So to do that, we move on to the Hamiltonian formalism.
Is the Einstein gravity lambda equals 1?
Yes. This is the anisotropic parameter, like alpha in the causal dynamical triangulations.
Okay.
Yes, but if we take this lambda equals 1, this disappears.
So lambda equal 1 is gravity.
I'm sorry?
Lambda equals 1 is gravity.
Lambda equals to 1.
What is the value lambda has for gravity?
For Einstein gravity.
For Einstein gravity.
Yes, Einstein gravity.
What is the value of lambda for Einstein gravity?
1. But I shall explain later. But after quantization, we can take the alpha equals to 0, the alpha to the 1 limit. After the quantization. All right. To move on to the Hamiltonian formalism, we define the conjugate momentum for gamma. And of course, gamma and pi satisfies this sort of Poisson bracket. And by the Legendre transformation, one finds the Hamiltonian. As in the GL, this is the linear combination of the Hamiltonian constraint and the diffeomorphism constraint. And then, to kill the spatial diffeomorphism invariance, we solve this diffeomorphism constraint. This is very interesting. If we solve this diffeomorphism constraint, then the conjugate momentum just becomes the function of only time. All right? The plugging this to a Hamiltonian, and you can reach out this expression. This is very kind of amazing, because plugging this solution, you can reduce the two-dimensional field theory to a one-dimensional system. The here, L is the defined by the integral of gamma. The gamma is the square root of the spatial metric. So this is Gaussian-invariant. And next, let's check the...
I'm just confused on some simple point. You don't have full, in the time-like direction, you don't have full diffeomorphism invariance.
Yes.
So for, why did the Hamiltonian just look like a constraint? I mean, why?
It looks like a constraint. You mean this form?
When you go back, yes.
Yes.
Fresh and bridge. It's nothing but a combination of constraints, right? Is that right? You said these were just constraints. This H and H1.
Yes.
Hamiltonian constraints and diffeomorphism constraints.
Yes.
But usually you think of that happening when you have gauge invariants, but you've taken away some of the gauge invariants. So
yes. The important point is that this diffeomorphism constraint is a fast course. But on the other hand, this Hamiltonian constraint is not a local. It's a global constraint because of this Laplace function is only a function of t. So this is the difference.
So and the diffeomorphism constraint is still a gauge symmetry.
Yes, because of this, the special diffeomorphism is not broken.
Yeah, so you get in the end, you start with two phase-based degrees of freedom. And you lose two
phase-based degrees.
You have gamma and p gamma, and then you solve the diffeomorphism constraint. So
p gamma. P gamma. Yes.
So you have a zero-dimensional physical phase-space.
Zero-dimensional. And how did that happen?
We have two. You have a two-dimensional or two times infinity dimensional phase space, and you have one constraint.
I see.
Which is supposed to be gauge symmetry.
The spatial diffeomorphism.
The spatial diffeomorphism.
Thank you. Yes. The next, let's check the Hamiltonian constraint. This is a global one. And this part in the parenthesis is a Hamiltonian constraint. If you think about this is zero, then you can find this solution. And this is a solution if the right-hand side is positive, because the left-hand side is a square. So if this is true, it means that the conjugate momentum is just a constant. So it means that no dynamics. So to get the non-trivial dynamics, we just think about this right-hand side is negative. And in that case, there is another solution. That is L equals to zero from this expression. So to get the non-trivial dynamics, we sit on this parameter region. Then we just do the path integral of this formalism. And it is path integral formalism. There is no problematic behavior around the L equals to zero.
So there's no classical limit in the regime?
A classical limit regime is...
Yes.
Limit.
So this is... regime which has no classical.
You mean the alpha equals 1 is the GR limit?
No, he means no solution of the classical equations of motion.
There's no classic, yeah.
No classical dynamics.
No classical solution.
There is a classical solution, which he says is wrong in the metric.
Yeah. Which one?
The one with no dynamics.
Yeah, but the metric is degenerate, so zero metric.
No, that is the second option. Yes. Mm-hmm. The first one was no dynamics. The first one.
No, no, but in the regime he's looking at, there is no classical solution.
Yeah, no, the solution. Second. That is the second
so,
option. Which
yes.
Before
so
that,
then,
before that, there's
yeah, yeah,
no
yeah.
dynamics, which I think might be classical.
So the regime you're looking at is a regime which has no classical regime, no classical solution. There is no classical solution to the regime.
For the Hamiltonian one, yes.
Well, to gravity, yeah, to the system you're looking at. So your system is purely quantum. It doesn't have any classical limit. In this regime.
I see.
But aren't you doing something funny? So actually also in this regime, you look at into the case where I think the diffeomorphism constraint is singular. Because the diffeomorphism constraints was something like P divided by gamma.
This one?
Yeah. And you look into if gamma is supposed to be positive.
You mean this one? Is
yeah, and you look into I is equal to zero. And so if you have basically two, if you start with two variables and have one constraint, indeed dynamics is basically trivial. So I think the more regular choice would be to look at into the thing where you have written in red no dynamics.
You're saying that we have to treat more carefully about this region.
Yeah, this region. I mean, yeah. So this region is where the constraint is singular. The diffeomorphism constraint is singular.
Yes.
That and that might be the reason that you give that you get a more interesting, a non-trivial dynamical system because you basically look into a regime where. I'm not sure it's really more interesting because it's a totally degenerate case.
I see.
When you look into the case where the length of the loops is zero.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But firstly, if you solve the diffeomorphism constraint, this numerator equals to zero. So this diffeomorphism constant is not singular if we take the gamma equals to zero. So maybe we should think about it more carefully. So we're sitting on this parameter region, and we move on to the path integral, this is the action which determines the dynamics of L, and here this. Lambda tilde is defined by the some Dressed cosmological constant. And here there is very important things. We have two kinds of the physical quantities. And the first one is the proper time. And the proper time is usually defined by the integral of the Laplace function. And in our case, the Laplace function is only the function of t. So this proper time does not depend on the space. So it means that this is a gauge invariant. And on the other hand, we have the macroscopic group. This is also invariant. So we have two invariant quantities. Then it is a very legitimate question to ask for the path integral of the fixed boundary length. And separated by the proper time t. This capital T is the proper time. And we define the state which have the eigenvalue L1 and think about the propagation with the proper time and enter the state with the eigenstate L2.
So what is your H? No, I'm confused. Which H do you use? What H do you use?
From now, I will define it. So I will define the left-hand side by path integral, and we read off this quantum Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, there's some. Before you told us that L had to be zero, but now L is not zero. That was only classically had to be zero, or
A class, yes. If we solve the Hamiltonian constant, L is zero. Classical is zero.
Yeah.
But in quantum, it is not.
It's not a constraint at the quantum level.
Sorry.
So it doesn't become a constraint at the quantum level.
No. But that's why it becomes an exponential minus, because there's no classical solution. So usually an amplitude should be exponential I something, but because it, you know, it's never there, it's purely, there's no classical limit, so that's why you get a minus sign. It's not because of some weak rotation, it's because you're frustrating the system to have no classical limit. So that's why you get only a decaying amplitude. There's nothing to do with weak rotation. That's to do with the fact that There's no classical limit of your system.
But it takes a weak rotation.
What?
It takes to make an explicit rotation.
No, but not here. Before, maybe, but here, there's no classical limit to the system. Right? So there, your quantum amplitude is like a tunneling amplitude.
But then the quantum amplitude doesn't have, I mean, when you calculate the stuff, you don't have a constraint. Keep your amplitude zero anymore. Even at the bottom.
Is there some operator version of that constraint?
It's
like a tunnel amplitude.
But to escape from such a problem, we can fix the space time boring as some constant. In that case, we can think about the cosmological constant as the Lagrange multiplier, which should be fixed. In that case, we may get the non-trivial classical dynamics.
Okay.
Thank you. And we define this propagator based on the path integral. And we move on to the Euclidean signature.
Yeah, it's
and nice. Then.
But then I know you put minus, I'm confused. So,
yeah, so
yeah, you
thing is
you should point. Put an I now. Right? Weak
rotated thing.
So weak rotated things of something that doesn't have a classical limit. So I'm confused what we're. I mean, if it doesn't have a classical limit, you should not need any weak rotation because it means it should be like a tunneling amplitude. It should be the quantum object should already be exponentially decaying. Okay.
But if we fix the volume of the space-time, it could be okay.
Yeah, but then you have a different classical system that you did not study, right? Where you have variables conjugated to the. I mean, it's this. What is it called? Projectable.
Unimodular
gravity, but then you have other degrees of freedom. So it's a different classical theory. You can make lambda a variable which is conjugate to the volume, but then you need to add these variables in your phase space, and then extend the phase space, extend the constraint space, and then the integration of the variables should also be integrated over these things.
Yes, but
I mean, it's a different.
But in the case with the Lube graph D, we just do the same thing. To get the non-trivial dynamics, we fix the volume.
And in the case of
UV, right?
Lube, yes.
No, I'm saying you could do that, but I'm just saying that the analysis you did before should be changed. Because you have other degrees of freedom. I mean, in your analysis, lambda is not a dynamical variable.
Okay.
I mean, here, do you fix the volume? I don't see the volume fixed here, but.
Yeah, we fix the volume, and we think about the lambda as the some some fixed values in this case.
Lambda is fixed too?
Yes, if it fixes the volume of the spacetime, and then the lambda is the some Lagrange multiplier, so it should be fixed at some volume.
How do you fix the volume in this case?
So, I didn't write down explicitly, but to fix the volume, we put the delta function, but the volume is the sum constant. Mm-hmm. Okay. to do this path integral, we integrate all the functions. For example, the Laplace. We integrate the Laplace function and we construct the proper time t. And we fix the boundary lengths is L1 and L2. So to compute this quantity, all we should need is the one-step propagator, like in the CDT. So if you think about the proper time is very, very short, then we can write down this expression. As epsilon is the Laplace spacing, small time step. And then, so let's think about the this equation. We define some wave function, and its argument L1. And we, when we think about the infinitesimal time propagations by adding this infinitesimal propagator and summing up the intermediate loop lengths. And this quantity has up at the leading order is the psi of the L2. And the second leading, you get the quantum Hamiltonian. And here, capital A is the some normalization constant. And small a could be 1 or 0. It depends on the it depends on the boundary is marked or not. I should explain later. So what we should do is just compute the left-hand side and to lead off the quantum Hamiltonian. Okay, so plugging this expression into the path integral, and then you find this expression, then you do the integral over L, and finally you find this form. And if you choose A, this is a constant. In this way, you can normalize the wave function. And now you can compare this with the right-hand side. And if you look at the subplating term, you can get the quantum Hamiltonian in this form. Okay. This is our quantum Hamiltonian. And this lambda tilde is dressed by some anisotropic parameter. So let's take a look at closely. This A could be 1 or 0. If we take A as 0, then the measure becomes flat, flat measure, because the definition is like this. And in the case A equals to 0, the corresponding quantum Hamiltonian is this one. And this flat measure stands for a marker point, like a CDT. And so, and as I explained in the beginning, this is exactly the same with the CDT Hamiltonian with the marker point. And on the other hand, if you take A is 1, the measure has this form. And in the case of this measure, you find an unmarked point. So all the reference are gauged in this case. In this case, the corresponding Hamiltonian becomes this one. And I didn't explain in my talk, but in the original paper of the CDT by Yanambion and Renato, they find that this Hamiltonian corresponds to the CDT, is exactly the same with the CDT Hamiltonian with the unmarked loop. Okay, let me summarize my talk. We start with, yes.
Sorry, what was A exactly? How did it?
It's A.
Yeah, but how did it arise? The small A.
A small A.
That was whether it was marked loop or not marked. Wasn't it? One value was for a marked loop and the other value was for a non-marked.
Yes. So, for example.
But when you derived it in Hochschild-Lipschitz gravity, how did that A?
Language. In the case of Hochschild-Lipschitz, also the loop length is not dependent on coordinate. Right. In that case, it is possible to put the reference like a marker point.
But what is A?
I think it means,
yes.
Is this what it means? When you implement the diffeomorphism invariant or diffeomorphism constraint, do you do all diffeomorphisms or do you require them to fix a specific point on the loop? I assume that's the difference. Either the diffeomorphism group includes rotations or
yes.
It doesn't include
yes.
rotations.
Yes. So in the unmarked case, this is gauged.
No, but in your case, in Hochschild-Lipschitz, there's no marking. So what is A? A has any value.
No, I think there is a mark. I think he is considering two different diffeomorphisms.
I don't know. No, A is
a diffeomorphism.
So how the what is A? How does that appear in Hochschild-Lipschitz? A has any value?
One or zero.
Why?
Because I want to make a contact with the geometric interpretation.
Good, but in Hochschild-Lipschitz, what is the value of A? Is it constraints? What is A in Hochschild-Lipschitz? How do you define it?
I think there's two versions of Hochschild-Lipschitz, depending on whether you use the full diffeomorphism group or only a subgroup of it, which fixes a marked point.
I don't know. Here, A seems to be able to take any value.
No, he says only. Oh, it could, but it really is only allowed to be 0 or 1.
Why?
Because one case is where you use the full diffeomorphism group.
I don't.
In the other case.
Can I explain
well,
that?
You'd have to go through and work out the measure.
I don't know. Yeah.
Some Fedev Popov determinant or something.
Is that the case?
It comes out as an L and 1.
What is A?
But if you take any value of A, I don't understand the geometric meaning of this A.
So what
kind of amplitude we have computed?
So where does A come from? In Hochschild-Lipschitz. How do you define it?
Define.
What is A?
What is A?
How do we know when A is 0 and when A should be 1?
So, for example, yes. we think about, say, unmarked. A marked propagator.
In Hausdorff ellipses?
Yeah, no, but
in Hausdorff ellipses. In Hausdorff ellipses.
So can you, Hausdorff ellipses, it seems, is the previous slide. You wanted to define this path integral. Originally, there's no A in this path integral. So I guess A comes as some kind of quantization ambiguity of some sort. Or I just, how does it come in your problem, A?
Can you go back to the previous page?
Yes.
So here's some, you know, before this slide there was no A, and now there's A.
Left hand side, and first there is no A, and then in the second line of it you get A.
First line has A.
Oh, first line has
it's
A.
It's the measure.
Okay.
Where does that come
from?
I mean,
what's the big A? Just some normalization.
Yeah.
So in the previous slide there was no small A. Right?
I thought you were asking about the other
element. Because we didn't write down explicitly. We just write down this D L. This can be defined by this measure.
So A can have any value.
A can have any value, but it has only this interpretation of marked and unmarked for A equal to 0 and A equal to 1.
So at some point it has to do with computing properly your Fadier Popov.
I think that's what it
means. But you need to do this computation.
Yeah, it's also determined whether the Hamiltonian is set, if you want to have it self-adjoint or symmetric, I mean self-adjoint or not.
Yeah, there should be a self-justification for the value of A in our value sheets.
And that's what there's two different Hamiltonians where you get different values of A.
So usually DL is fixed. Once you define the quantization procedure, you cannot choose the measure at will. It comes from
So
you should do the gauge fixing properly and see what is the left of the measure.
Considering two different sets of geomorphisms.
Maybe. Well, it would be a check that it works. Right? You cannot just pick any measure. The measure is defined.
In principle, yes.
So you should compute the measure. And then find.
Oh, didn't you compute that?
I'm sorry.
No, you put it.
Did you just write down this L to the A, or did it actually comes out of a computation? This L1, the first line.
First one, yeah.
On the left. Up in the top, yeah.
The measure.
Where the little A appears. Measure,
yeah.
Yes. Are you just guessing that, or you computed it?
If we specify the quantity we compute, we can determine this A in Hausdorff ellipses.
And you did some calculation that you're not showing us that leads to that expression?
You mean the...
Did you compute some sort of, I don't know, Fadier Popov determinant or something like that? Or just something even simpler? But
like the Polyakov computation of the measure for
relativistic
particle, it computes exactly the measure. So did you do the computation or you're just guessing? Looks like you're just guessing.
If we mark a point, for example, this norm. Let's say we think about unmark. In this case, the reference degrees of freedom should be gauged. So in this sense, we divide by L1. So because we have the L1 times the possible way of the putting the mark. So this directly says that the completion this equation. So if you think about the Hojava lattice, in its L is the continuum. So we take this completeness relation, and then right here. If you split this propagator into the two pieces, like this is defined by L1, E minus H hat T, and I'm sorry, in this two, it's L1, okay. In this, and of course this can be split into the two pieces, like plug this one into here, then you find the corresponding measure is LDL. This is the case for the unmarked version. So in this sense, we compute this A. So I wrap up my talk, and we show that the CT becomes the projectable version of Hojava Lipschitz at the outer bound. And this critical point is unique. This is the case only for the two dimensions. In four dimensions, they have a more rich phase structure. So there could be an isotropic point as well. But in two dimensions, this is unique. And we have some conjecture that we can construct some sort of generalization of the CDT. And this generalized CDT has the foliation structures, but one allows the branching. It means that there are some baby universe creations. But in that case, if you take a continuum limit, you find a different field theory, which is unknown. And this could be some non-projectable version of the Hojava Lipschitz. Because in a CDT, we pick up the projectable version of the Hojava Lipschitz. And thanks to this case, thanks to this fact, we can reduce the two-dimensional field theory to a one-dimensional quantum mechanics. And from the point of view of the quantum mechanics, one can see the field theory interactions, which is the creation of the baby universe. So in the case of non-projectable version, maybe we can reduce the two-dimensional field theory to a one-dimensional system. In this sense, probably it could be the case. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Sure. In CDT,
yes.
You got that I mean, any value of lambda would work, any value of alpha would work.
In CDT.
Whereas here you have to have the cosmological constant to be positive and lambda to be less than one, right? So how do you recover the limit of GR?
In the case of observable lapses, we cannot. We cannot take a GR limit. If you look at the Hamiltonian, if you want to take R equals to 1, then this kind of this diverge, so we can take such a limit.
GR theory of 2D is empty.
Yeah, so maybe hard to recover.
But so there was one paper by Visser and Weinfurter and so on, where they wrote every most general action of 2D Ojama Lipschitz. And you say it's basically it's equivalent to GR or for the action of all theta that's
Yes, in a more general case, it could be possible to take lambda equals to 1, for example. But it's just a speculation.
You've shown that at the quantum level, the Hamiltonian is the same. As to CDT.
Yes.
But the action isn't.
Because in the case of CDT, there is no Lagrangian description, so I can say.
There are no more urgent questions. You can still around today and tomorrow. If you have more questions, you can ask them later. So let's thank them again.